The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A teenaged girl challenges tradition in Mongolia. Prisoners struggle with the effects of solitary confinement. A hedge fund manager becomes an unlikely activist. And a disabled teen grapples with what it means to become an independent adult. These are just some of the subjects covered in Framed. It's a new documentary film series that is kicking off this week. Nancy Schaefer started the South by Southwest Film Festival and was for many years director of the renowned Tribeca Film Festival. She curated the Framed series in a small New England town to show the range and vitality of what may be a digital golden age for documentaries. The films will be shown for the next six Thursday nights at Next Stage in Putney, Vermont, followed by Q&As with the filmmakers. Nancy Schaefer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have been curating films for 25 years. Production has changed, distribution, the way people watch movies has changed so much in those years. What has this meant for documentaries?
Well, it's meant sort of a host of things. One is, you know, I was at South by Southwest through the whole sort of digital revolution when all of a sudden everyone could pick up a camera and shoot something, and that's obviously great for filmmakers. It does mean that there's a glut of films. You know, there's just a lot of content out there everywhere you look. And we want filmmakers to get paid for their work. We want creators to be supported. So we have to find the best stories to distinguish filmmakers today.
So how did you find him? There's so many great ones out there. What were you looking for as a curator?
Well, I like to find a range of projects. So as you said in your introduction, we have, you know, we have one for family, which is The Eagle Huntress. We have one on comedy, one on music, one on Wall Street, one on prison reform. And so we have a host of issues and something for everyone. And that's how I like to program. I want everyone to feel welcome at the things that I put together.
Well, of course, documentaries, they have to be passion projects. It can take filmmakers just years to follow a subject and then produce it. But this all begins with a moment of discovery. Now, there's a great story behind this one. It's called The Eagle Huntress. But let's just hear a bit from the film.
For over 1,000 years, the nomads of the Altai Mountains have hunted with golden eagles, a precious skill that has traditionally been handed down from father to son. But now a young girl is setting out to become a master eagle hunter.
That is Daisy Ridley narrating the film by the director Otto Bell. What led him to The Eagle Huntress?
Well, I have never actually heard it from his own mouth, but the story I've heard is that he saw a picture of Aisha Opan, who's the lead of the focus of the story. He saw a picture of this young girl. It landed on his desk, and he set off to find her. And the thing about documentary is it's all very much about chance. Sometimes these little ideas turn into great big stories, and sometimes they don't lead anywhere. So Otto, the director, obviously he stumbled onto something very big.
It's just a gorgeously filmed story and one of those glimpses we get through documentaries of a world away. Another universe we don't see is in Solitary. This is directed by Christy Jacobson. Tell us a little bit about this film.
So this is a film about a maximum security prison in Virginia. Basically, the Virginia prison system, from what I learned from the film, takes the worst of the worst from all their prisons, or I don't know how many prisons they have, and they put them in this one prison facility. So all these people live in solitary confinement. And as we're all aware, there's a lot of prison reform issues being discussed in this country lately and about punishment and what we need to do to fix our prison system and to help make our prisoners better people when they get out in the world, and Solitary addresses those issues.
The filmmaker interviews several inmates, also the warden, by the way, and also the guards. But here is Randall. He's now 35. He figures he's been incarcerated since he was about 11 years old.
You know, we went to a pretty nice school, actually, and we were, I mean, by far the poorest there, you know, so we got picked on, made fun of and stuff like that. And just started fighting, you know. I never bullied anybody, but I would always pick fights with the bullies because I hated it. I know what it feels like to be put down and made fun of, so I would take the bullies, I'd stuff their heads in the toilets, you know. That's just all I've ever known was how to fight. My dad made me fight, you know, with sawed off 2x4s, just to toughen us up and make us hard. He said, if you get into a fight, you damn sure better finish it. And if you lose, I'm gonna beat your ass for it.
That's Randall, one of many prisoners, or inmates rather, at a supermax prison in Virginia, interviewed for the film Solitary. That's showing on April 6th at the Framed series. I'm speaking with the curator of the series, Nancy Schaefer. So interesting, Nancy. I mean, we don't get from that film, you know, numbers of how many Americans or poor Americans are in prison, but we get to see and hear the effect of being confined in these 8x10 cells for 23 hours a day. This is a kind of form of filmmaking, I don't know, it's such a different approach than mainstream produced films, which you now work on for a living. What is the difference to you? What do we get here?
Well, so one of the things that I loved as a programmer for film festivals for years was documentary, was finding these great stories that that people haven't heard before, and that mainstream news may not have the time or the energy, frankly, to follow. So one of the things documentary do, especially social justice documentaries like Solitary, is they find these stories and they present them without bias. So it's really up to us to take what we want from these stories and figure out how they reflect on our lives and our choices. So Solitary is very much in that vein. It doesn't tell us what to think, but it tells us how these people are living, and we're allowed to draw our own conclusions.
Yeah, and it is a sort of way of seeing life on the American margins that I don't think is necessarily the kind of demographic that a lot of mainstream media is looking for.
Right. And for me, I now produce pretty much exclusively narrative, dramatic feature films. So for me to find these stories in documentary, when I was approached by Next Stage, they said, we have a new little venue and we're excited to do some dramatic, interesting programming. Will you do a documentary series for us? I thought, well, what fun. You know, what fun to show a really strong intellectual audience that they have there in Putney, Vermont, and surrounds some great, great filmmaking about issues and things that are affecting us today. And whether, you know, for me, documentary can be social justice, it can also be character driven, it can also be comedic, it can, you know, there's a whole host of range of things that can be presented in documentaries, and they're all, for me, viable films and you know, things that people will want to see.
Well, let's go for another one in that social justice vein, or exposing an uncovered story. That's an ongoing documentary trend, you know, stirring up outrage in our sense of social justice. This is a clip from Ted Braun's Betting on Zero.
What are you accusing Herbalife of?
Being a pyramid scheme.
This is a legitimate company. That's a bogus accusation.
Multi-level marketing. They tap into beliefs we have that you can accomplish whatever you want to.
The wildest dreams you've ever thought of can come true in Herbalife.
They took my dreams, my hope to be successful.
A clip there from Betting on Zero from director Ted Braun. It is one of the films being shown at Framed, a series that is starting in Putney, Vermont this week. Nancy Schaefer is a longtime director of the Tribeca Film Festival, is the curator. She's talking with us about some of the films that are going to be shown. So tell us a little bit more about Betting on Zero, just a very strong, character-driven kind of film.
So this is a really interesting case, and it shows how documentaries sort of fit into our world. The filmmakers started out making this film about an activist investor whose name is Bill Ackerman. And he has really championed the anti-Herbalife cause. He believes that Herbalife is subjugating poorer people and taking their money, and it's a pyramid scheme and all this that you'll learn in the film. Bill Ackerman is all over the New York Times and Wall Street Journal these days because his very large hedge fund is, you know, taking a lot of hits on all of its investments right now. So it's very interesting to see how this story, which probably took 2 or 3 years to make, is like completely in the zeitgeist of what's happening in the business news right now.
And these long time for filmmakers to make films like this, what are the biggest challenges for documentary filmmakers now?
Well, the biggest challenge is making a living. I mean, this is a problem with all filmmakers who are more on the sort of grassroots filmmaking side outside of Hollywood. And I typically work outside of Hollywood, and I work on what's called independent film. It's just very hard to make a living. There, people are not valuing content in the way they should be paying more money for it. And it's just an uphill battle.
Let's get to the film that is actually kicking this festival off. It's called Best and Most Beautiful Things. The main subject of the film is Michelle. In this little clip, she sneaks into a hotel pool with her new boyfriend. His name is Michael.
I seriously, like, was telling my friend Sam about you.
Mm-hmm.
And told him about all these different things. You've got, like, a great personality. You are really funny. She's sexy. It wasn't until he made a joke, like, why would she date you? Was she blind or something? I'm like, oh, yeah, she's blind.
1, 2, 3.
Clip from The Best and Most Beautiful Things, a film about a young woman, Michelle Smith, who is legally blind. She also has Asperger's syndrome. The filmmaker, Garrett Zevgetis, followed her for several years, but the movie focuses on her when she's entering her 20s. Now, what did you see in this film, Nancy, that grabbed you?
Well, we see, and rightly so, a lot of films about people sort of conquering their disabilities or overcoming the perceived stereotypes of how they should live with a disability. And our lead in this, Michelle, is so full of life that you're sort of marvel at her the whole way through the film, because she has not just conquered or moved on or moved past being blind. She has embraced life and grabbed it. And you just kind of look at her in awe through the whole movie. Like, you go, girl, you know? So I really enjoyed her. She's just a huge character, and I'm sure that's why Garrett chose her. She just is larger than life.
Yeah, and throughout the film, she's springing into this world as a person with disabilities. You know, she's been in a kind of protective environment. Now she has the capacity to make her own lifestyle decisions. But there is a question of, you know, whether she really has consent to explore this fetishistic BDSM lifestyle she's engaging in. How does a filmmaker negotiate those kind of questions of consent?
Well, I think, like I said before, I think the best the filmmaker can do is present all sides of the issue and let you... Filmmakers are typically, unless they're making some kind of screed or diatribe, which they should tell you, they're trying to be impartial. So his way of doing it is to present all the information and let us make the decision as to whether we feel she's being exploited.
For this Frame series, all of the filmmakers are going to come and talk to audiences after the films are shown. That is not something we normally get up here in New Hampshire. What do you think audiences will get that they don't normally get from seeing a film in a theater?
I think one of the great things that this series is doing is bringing the filmmakers to town with their films, because what we do as film festival people is we go to festivals and we get to hear from filmmakers. That doesn't happen when a movie shows in a movie theater across the country. So one of the things we're trying to do with the Frame series is bring together the people who actually made the stories so that they can have a one-on-one conversation with the audience after the film. And I think that's why people love film festivals, is they get that communication, that dialogue with the filmmakers.
Well, we did not get to talk about Tickling Giants. This is about an Egyptian surgeon who started a satirical online TV show that became a huge hit. And Miss Sharon Jones, about the singer who finally achieved fame in midlife when she gets diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And this is a terrific film. Barbara Koppel, the filmmaker, follows her through her treatment and a tour that followed before she did actually die of cancer at age 60. We're going to leave you with Sharon Jones singing 100 Days, 100 Nights.
100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart.
Nancy Schaefer, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Nancy Schaefer, she's formerly director of the Tribeca Film Festival and curator of Framed. That's a documentary series running for the next 6 Thursdays at Next Stage in Putney, Vermont. All the screenings will be followed by conversations with the filmmakers. There's more information at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
Hallie Efron wore a few hats before she started writing fiction. She taught grammar school and college and worked as a corporate marketing and education consultant. Today, she is a New York Times best-selling author of 9 mystery and suspense novels, including the forthcoming You'll Never Know, Dear. She's a sought-after writing teacher and author of a guide to writing and selling mystery, suspense, and crime novels. She's going to be leading a workshop on that very topic for the New Hampshire Writers Project's Writers Day on April the 1st. She's also going to be on a panel listening to and, let's say, reacting to the first 500 words of unpublished manuscripts. And Hallie Efron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Virginia. I'm happy to be here.
So you've actually written an award-winning book on how to turn a big idea into a book and getting it published. It's just been recently revised and expanded. So what in your mind are some essential ingredients for a gripping mystery novel?
A gripping mystery novel. It has to have, you know, this sounds counterintuitive. Plot is important, and you would think that it would be, and it has to be a page-turner, of course. But I think the real key is great characters, and characters that the reader cares about. Even the villain has to be a character that you believe could exist in this world and might see what they're doing as the right thing for them. So I always focus on first plot, but character after that.
Yeah, and I know that you go through in your book, you know, doing openings and structure and viewpoints and secrets and scenes. But the main thing for you is somebody that we want to care about?
Actually, yes. And that should be the main character, whoever is solved. In a mystery, we think of it as the sleuth. Could be a police officer, could be a firefighter, could be a reporter, could be a librarian. There could be anything. But it's the person who has something at stake, something to lose, something important. And that's the person who needs to solve whatever the crime is.
You wrote the On Crime book review column. This was for the Boston Globe for years. Curious about what you learned about writing as a book critic, you know, very inside baseball look and really picking apart other people's work.
What did I learn? I think I learned that it's a very big umbrella, the one that covers crime fiction, from the coziest of Miss Marple kinds of books to really hard-edged Jack Reacher novels to big books like The Da Vinci Code, and that within that, even though there are so many differences, there are still a lot of things that are similar. The character with a reason to care, the great opening, pacing, the moving parts are pretty much the same. I tried never to be glib at the expense of someone else's ego. I think writers are tender little shoots, and I don't think it behooves anyone to make fun or belittle the writing just because it's easy. The book critic is writing an essay that should not be about the book critic. It should be about the book.
A number of writers that we've spoken with and writing teachers, they urge those who are aspiring to be authors to just sit down and write, get her done, you know, get it down, not to worry about appealing to others or to selling it. But you've written a book about that very thing. So where does the strategy for selling come into the process?
First, let me just say that one of my first pieces of advice in the book to writers is just hold your nose and write. So I really do appreciate if you don't get that book written as stinky as the first draft is, you'll never get it good enough to sell, which is your next question. And it is a very tough market out there right now because if just to get the attention of a publisher, it has to be really good and it has to be what they're looking for, which is like clairvoyance. Who knows what they're looking for? You start your book in September this year. It's not going to be ready until at least a year out. And then who knows how the market will have changed by then. So I really do believe you have to write what you want to write, what you care about. Hold your nose and write to get started and then edit. Give it to people to read whose advice you trust.
So you're not following trends and writing for what's hot in the marketplace now. What are some other things that you might advise people to avoid?
Definitely don't chase trends. But The other thing, I think, is to focus too much on the story and not enough on the characters. Sometimes somebody starts writing a mystery novel and all they're thinking about is what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next, not who's my main character and what are they feeling now and what could happen next.
Of course, you have to start with a great idea. Now, I read that you got your idea for your first suspense novel at a yard sale.
What happened? Well, let me say also, when I started writing, I didn't think I had anything to write about. So my first mystery novels were written with a co-author who had a really interesting life. And it wasn't until we were done with that that I got the confidence to look in my own life for story ideas. And then came that yard sale. I went to a yard sale around the corner from where we live. Beautiful Victorian house. I had known the owners who previously owned it. I knew the house inside and out. New owners redecorating. I'm asking the woman all about what they've done to the interior. And finally she says, "Would you like to go inside and look around?" And I thought, you bet I would. And I went inside through the kitchen door. And there's something very creepy about being in someone else's empty house. You know, you're sure someone's going to come popping out of the closet at you. But I persevered. I looked downstairs and upstairs. And somewhere in there, the mystery writer in me kicked in. And I thought, what if a woman goes to a yard sale? What if she talks her way into the house? And what if she never comes out? And I just got chills down my spine. I ran home. It was within walking distance of my house. And the yard sale is the first scene of Never Tell a Lie.
That book that you came out with in 2009. Now, this was after writing five of these books in the psychological suspense thriller series, the Peter Zak series, as they're called. But doing this on your own, what did that feel like for you?
It felt scary, and particularly with that book. I got stuck many times with that book, not knowing. There's a point in that book where the character gets locked somewhere, and she's 9 months pregnant. I just got stuck there for like 8 weeks trying to figure out how the heck to get her out of there in a believable way, until I finally did. And when you're writing with a partner, those knot holes are so much easier to work your way through than when you're all alone, just staring at the keyboard all by yourself. You know, writing groups are only helpful up to a point, because really you want to decide your own way to get your character out of that situation. But it was scary.
My guest is Hallie Efron. She's a longtime crime fiction book critic for the Boston Globe and author of several best-selling mystery and suspense novels. She's going to be at the New Hampshire Writers Project for Writer's Day on April the 1st to talk about how to craft a page-turner. And she's also on the panel for something called Beginnings. It's an on-the-spot critique for the beginnings of books. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. What about when it's not working? I think you call it the piece of... well, we'll call it poop stage.
Well, I also say, you know, as a writer, you have your good days and your bad. You have your days when everything you write, you just think, this is awful. And then there are other days where you think everything's wonderful. And neither of those is right, because 2 days later, you'll look at what you wrote that you thought was terrible, and doesn't smell that bad. And the stuff that you thought was great actually needs a lot of work. So I think as a writer... you really have to be careful to overinflate your own sense of yourself. Just keep writing, keep plugging, keep revising. Some days it'll be good, some days it won't be good, and that's just the way it is.
Yes. Snaky and unsettling. And then you come out with some suggestions for people, like reading the news. Put these in your folder to see what happens. That's one story. Severed feet, still inside shoes, keep watching up on beach. Oh, a woman finds a bullet in the pork butt she's cooking. I don't know. Hallie, do you just have to have a slightly twisted, skewed mind to write this kind of stuff?
I think you have to write about the things that intrigue you. I mean, for instance, there's a lot of news stories that I would never write about because I think the stories are too sad, too heart-wrenching. I always like something that's got a little bit of a creepy, maybe even slightly funny twist to it. And I also never, ever torture women or kill babies in my books. I mean, I really don't like to go there, even though you'll find plenty of stories in the news about just those very things. It's not what I want to write about. So I write creepy. I would say I write creepy, but I don't write icky.
Okay. We'll keep that definition in mind. You come from a very literary family. Your parents wrote Broadway plays together, movie screenplays for Carousel, for example. What did you witness about the writing life from them growing up?
Well, my parents were Hollywood screenwriters during the golden age of cinema, when writers had contracts, they had studio offices, secretaries. They wrote movie after movie. My parents wrote maybe two or three movies a year, and they all were produced. You know, they worked with Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy, Fred Astaire, Ethel Merman, and it was a fabulous time, but it ended very abruptly at around the time that Cleopatra was made, because that bankrupted 20th Century Fox,
They went way over budget, right?
Way over what is still the most expensive movie ever made, they say, in today's dollars. And so I witnessed both the upside and the downside. I witnessed what happens when you're a success and what happens when you're a failure, and how out of your control it can sometimes be. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't start writing until I was in my 40s, because I could really see what could happen to you if you're not a big hit. It's very painful.
And this despite the fact that you had sisters. Nora Ephron, your sister, you've got Male, Julie and Julia, great writer and screenplay writer, Delia, Amy. It was kind of the family business. So this was it a rejection of the family business for you?
I was a rebel, and in my family, being a rebel meant instead of writing, I was a teacher. You know, I could have done worse. I could have been a nurse. That would have horrified my mother even more, a feminist that she was. I was afraid of failing, and I didn't want to be compared, which would be so easy, my work to my sisters. That's probably why I write crime novels, because they don't.
What's the best advice that you ever got, Hallie, about writing?
I would say kill the narrator. Kill the author. I used to have a little yellow sticky on my computer that said that, kill the author, kill the narrator. And I got it from the first writing teacher I ever worked with, whose name was Arthur Edelstein, who worked at the Radcliffe Seminars. And I took his class several semesters in a row. And his point was the book should be narrated, should be told, should be conveyed to the reader through the viewpoint of the character, not the author. And that's all about viewpoint and voice and point of view, which are things I didn't understand at all when I started writing. You just don't think about them when all you do is read. But the minute you start writing, when it's not working, that's often why. Viewpoint and voice.
How about worst advice? Did anyone ever tell you anything that you just learned later? Oh, that was ridiculous.
I think you can't do that. And then fill in whatever that is, because I think every writing rule has been broken by someone who did it really well. Gone Girl is a really good example. They would have told you, you cannot write an unlikable protagonist and have a successful mystery novel. Well, that character, Amy, is about as unlikable as any character in fiction, as is her husband, Nick, who some people think is the protagonist. And yet, I mean, we all wish we wrote it.
Yeah, they've same done pretty well.
Yes. Yeah, The Da Vinci Code's another one. I mean, they will tell you character. How important is that? It's the most important thing. In The Da Vinci Code, it's all about plot. Character is very weak. And yet, it's a great book. It's a huge bestseller. So that's what I would say. Don't do that. Is just, you know, whatever that is, if you do it well, you can do it.
Well, Hallie Ephron, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Hallie Efron is the best-selling mystery and suspense novelist. Her newest, You'll Never Know, Dear, is coming out in June. She is among the legion helpful authors joining Writers' Day on Saturday, April the 1st at Southern New Hampshire University. You can find out more on her sessions, How to Craft a Page-Turner, and Beginnings. The information is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org or nhwritersproject.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for The Bookshelf, or in today's case, The Magazine Rack. Peter Biello, NHPR's host of All Things Considered, introduces us to an historic publication that helped put New Hampshire on the map.
The state of New Hampshire is as much an idea as it is a place. New Hampshire represents the idea of living simply, of living close to nature, and of course, living freely. In the early 1930s, the state began marketing itself as a kind of Yankee paradise with a magazine called the New Hampshire Troubadour. This magazine, long out of print, may be responsible for the way people outside New Hampshire think about it. Author Howard Mansfield recently wrote about the Troubadour for New Hampshire Magazine, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome, Howard.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Peter.
So the New Hampshire Troubadour, it wasn't something that you were familiar with until you went on, was it vacation in New Zealand?
Yeah, my wife, Cy Montgomery, was there riding on some of those crazy critters, you know, and I came over to do some hiking. And we were standing by this amazing lake. I think it was Lake Taupo. And it's this fantastic turquoise color. Unbelievable. You've never seen a lake like it. And it has black swans, not white swans, which are, I guess, pretty rare or common over there in New Zealand. And this fellow comes over and introduces himself and asks us where we're from. And we say, of course, the United States. And he goes, where? And we keep narrowing it down. Finally, we say New Hampshire. And he's like, it's like he hit the jackpot. He said, I always wanted to go there. We said, why? And he said, you know this magazine, New Hampshire Troubadour. We said, "No, we don't. So he and his wife had us back to his house for tea and showed us this little magazine. It's like pocket size. It has black and white illustrations. And it just captivated this fellow.
And this was a magazine, an original from either the 30s, 40s, or early 50s?
Yeah. The New Hampshire Troubadour was published by the state from 1931 to 1951. It's kind of an amazing, it's like an early episode in branding before people used that kind of language and were that cynical about it. I think each issue was really sincerely felt.
Meaning what exactly? The authors of the magazine actually sincerely believed that New Hampshire was a kind of Yankee paradise that the whole world should know about?
The first issues were probably created by this fellow named Thomas Dreyer. He was an advertising copywriter, and he made apparently a fortune publishing these business magazines with Company News and Positive Thinking. And to him, New Hampshire was a Yankee Shangri-La. It was the relief from the terrible Great Depression. Up here was beauty. Up here was contentment. And he wrote these little homilies about bringing in a birch log or at the farm, time flows smoothly, but we find contentment. And it has this kind of attitude that even though it's going out to city mice, we're all in on this together, you know? We all know that this is the way to live, and we all know that this is waiting for you should you ever come to New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. And that was a consistent vision throughout the life of this magazine.
Through Thomas Dreyer's tenure and through the next editor, too, was this fellow by the name of Don Tuttle, who ran it during the war, from the Depression to the World War II.
Mm-hmm. And some of the writers for this magazine, you listed two in your article. One was Ernest Elmo Calkins?
I'm not sure.
Maybe that's lost. The pronunciation's lost to history. And also Walter Dorwin Teague, who were pretty significant in their own right. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this really jumped out at me. I was in the New Hampshire Historical Society Library doing some research and I had some time. So I said, I'm going to look at some troubadours, you know, because it was in the back of my mind. And I was reading through what Dreyer wrote. And all of a sudden I see these names. And I know these names because I've written for international design magazines and architecture magazines in New York. And those two names you just mentioned, Walter Dorwin Teague and Ernest Elmo Calkins, they were pioneers in creating consumption demand for products. Teague designed the iconic Texaco station that you would think of, the white station with the three bands around it, and the Kodak camera that used to have the speed lines on it. And he also designed, for the 1939 World's Fair, the National Cash Register Building, which was a giant seven-story cash register on which each day they put the attendants up there in the little window. And Calkins really believed that we had to stimulate demand and consumption. People would just buy a stove and damn it, they would keep it forever. This was no good. So we wanted your stove to date, to go out of date, and wanted to create, as he said, dissatisfaction. He asked, can we create artificial obsolescence? That's what he believed in. And as the Depression came on, this became a big problem. You know, no one's buying anything, no one's producing anything. How do we get this going? So both these people, Teague and Calkins, are real cosmopolitan movers for the streamlined modern future. And here they are writing these little essays about how great it is to be summering under the elms here in this little village, Melvin Village, by Lake Winnipesaukee. Totally surprised me.
I know. I was going to ask, how do guys like that end up writing for a magazine that almost values and champions simplicity and easy living?
Well, that's just the question, isn't it? Now, our friend Thomas Dreyer was obviously a big advertising guy, so we would have known Calkins. Industrial design, as we call it today, started out as consumption engineering, and some of the first people in that field were from advertising. So they must have been in the same circles back in New York. I mean, that's all I can figure out.
Mm-hmm. How did they land on the name Troubadour?
I don't know. You know, he might have published, Dreyer might have published another magazine called Troubadour. I don't really know.
Overall, it seems like maybe the style has changed, but the substance of New Hampshire state marketing seems to be pretty much the same.
Well, here's the great thing that Thomas Dreyer knew. He knew he was creating this idea of New Hampshire, this image. I mean, it's all there in the description of his house. He said his house, which is 150 years old, he's talking about how wonderful it is, and it says the whole place suggests permanence, solidity, comfort, peace, and simplicity. And over again, he put New Hampshire forward as having that. And so people would come to New Hampshire to find that. So Dreyer knew that we live in our idea of the world as much as we live in the world. And this has certainly been true ever since the first white folks came here and named this place after an English county, an Englishman. So we've been living in the idea of New Hampshire ever since. That's one of the great things that he knows. And when you talk about selling a state today like New Hampshire or Vermont, that's you're selling the idea of the place. People to come up here and they're looking for that idea.
Huh. So to what extent do you think Dreyer is responsible for the way people outside New Hampshire understand what the state is?
Given that you could go over to New Zealand and find someone with this magazine who's totally entranced, he must have had a big hand, him and that other fellow I told you about who followed as the editor. It created a very strong image at a time when people maybe weren't that sophisticated about interrogating images. But, you know, it continues today. He was a great rusticator. Yeah, that's like a 19th century word for people who come to the country and think, oh, this is just lovely. And there's so many different versions of rustification and celebration of small town rural life that live and start in New England. You could just, there's a huge list.
So if you wanted to find a copy of The Troubadour, what would you have to do?
Well, you could go to the state library and read it. You could go on eBay. There's copies all over the place on eBay, I think. If you go to yard sales, I think I've seen them at yard sales kind of piled up. So I think it's just around, and given the prevalence of barns, I'm sure there's some sitting up there, a lot of issues sitting up in barns right now.
Well, Howard, thank you very much for coming in and talking about the New Hampshire Troubadour.
Sure, Peter. Great. I really enjoyed it.
That's Howard Mansfield. His article about the New Hampshire Troubadour is in the April issue of New Hampshire Magazine. And you can find a link to my conversation with Howard about his book about New Hampshire sheds and his top five reading recommendations at nhpr.org.
And that was The Bookshelf with host Peter Biello. You can listen to previous episodes or download the podcast. Just go to nhpr.org. Thanks so much for listening today. Music in this episode came to us from Tyler Gibbons and Jason Leonard. You can stay in touch with us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio or on Twitter at Word of Mouth. You can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to download the Word of Mouth podcast. We're just all over the place. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.